It's so great to be here today speaking with two of my favorite people, Alex and Joe, on my favorite subject, longevity. At NFX, we call longevity the transition from sick care to healthcare, where instead of the current state of waiting for somebody to get sick and playing a game of whack-a-mole with the different diseases that manifest as we get old, why not tackle the root cause of most diseases, which is aging? So let's start with a quick introduction. Joining us today is Joe from Retro Biosciences and Alex from the Age One Fund. So let's start with Joe. Can you please introduce yourself and say a bit about the company's mission?
Yeah, I'm Joe Betz-Lacroix and CEO of Retro Biosciences, which is a sort of medium-sized biotech startup in California that's about 60 people now. And we are very focused on our mission of adding 10 years of healthy lifespan to humanity.
Yeah, I love the mission. Always when we meet, I ask myself, why only 10 years?
I think that if we are successful in our mission, that I will be so incredibly proud of all of us, and that the impact on so many facets of society and people's lives will be so great that it feels enough for me as a person, impact-wise.
Yeah, and we can always have stretch goals. Great. Alex, can you please introduce yourself and the Age One Fund?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Omri, for having me on. But my name is Alex Coville. I'm the general partner and co-founder of Age One, which is a venture capital firm focused on longevity biotech specifically. So specifically focused on catalyzing and funding very early stage companies that are working to this goal, exactly like Joe's amazing goal of increasing healthy lifespan. We don't put a year on it for what it's worth. Maybe that's less ambitious or more ambitious. I don't know. But what I do know is that Age One, in essence, came from the Longevity Fund, which my co-founder, Laura Deming, made back in 2011 as kind of the first venture capital fund focused on the theme of longevity. And we're super, super excited to have introduced Age One last year and just to have closed our first fund out of this new vehicle. So, yeah.
Congratulations. I know what drew me to the space, but Joe, what drew you to longevity space?
I guess I went through a bit of a life transition. So I guess backing up, the only thing I really know how to do is startups. That's like the hammer. And so I go around the world looking for nails that I want to pound in. And originally it was doing things that were cool. That was enough for me. I think that's maybe it's a young person's game. But then after succeeding reasonably well at something cool, I decided I wanted to make something meaningful. And meaningful to me means people, because people are special compared to like everything else in the universe that we know of. And so of the things that are meaningful to people, like, you know, what affects like people's lives, like war, famine, poverty, displaced homes, all that kind of stuff. Pretty much all of that requires extreme political acumen, which I don't have. And I'm a nerd. So like, what can a technologist do? Of the things that I could work on technologically, by far and away the greatest source of human misery, and therefore the thing that could, if it were eradicated, could create the greatest source of human joy and thriving, is dealing with disease, which sounds like a huge, giant, you know, like boiling the ocean kind of task. But then looking at disease, like just stacking it up, like what are people suffering from at hospitals? What is money spent on at hospitals? It's like 85% age-related disease. So it's not like I have to go around and like fix kidney disease and fix psoriasis and fix like toe fungus or whatever, like all these diseases. It's like aging is basically it. It's basically, you know, pretty much all of disease that we ultimately deal with in the hospitals and so on is age-related disease. So that makes it more focusing for me. Well, I should figure out why they happen. What is this process called aging? And is there some way by addressing that itself, it could make the biggest difference?
That's great. And by the way, it's always amazed me how the kind of the backlash we're getting in the longevity space, where some people say, oh, you know, it's the tech bros want to live forever. Or other people think, oh, I don't want to be 90-year-old for 50 more years. And in my mind, what longevity is just staying healthy. The best healthcare is to be 22 years old, right? To be young and healthy. For me, longevity is staying young for as long as you want and involuntary death, right? That's my mission, at least. So Alex, you're a scientist, now investor. What made you first realize that this is what you want to spend your time on?
Yeah, for me, it was kind of like the 8-year-old moment of watching people go through the worst parts of age-related disease and kind of seeing somebody go through dementia, seeing somebody else go through cancer and kind of starting to ask why. And, you know, you kind of ask why a lot and like why there aren't more options to do something about like how horrific both of those diseases are and how much suffering comes with it. And like, it's just that game of why that you like keep asking why, and it just like, you don't really get the answer to your question. And, you know, people tell you, oh, because that's the way it is, or like, oh, that's life. That's aging. That's just like what we deal with. And people keep asking you why, and you just get more frustrated. And eventually I kind of like sat with that for probably like 5 or 6 years, pretty silently, just like very unhappy about it. And eventually that led to kind of late teens Googling more about it. And during undergrad, came across through my Googling this field of the biology of aging and longevity biotech that we're here to talk about today. And that was when I was like, holy cow, found my tribe. These are my people, and haven't looked back since.
Perfect. It's a great segue, because I really want to talk about the scientific history of longevity. In my mind, one of the rate limiting steps for longevity is a lack of scientifically valid things to do. There are not a lot of things you can do. And when we found one, there is a lot of energy behind it, right? So it's so important to discuss what's already have been discovered. So Alex, you've been doing research in this space for a while. AGE1, I think, is the first longevity gene, right? That's the name of your fund. So can you please talk a little bit about the kind of scientific history of longevity?
Yeah, so the scientific history of longevity is very interesting. And, you know, it's certainly not up to me to determine when exactly the field went from mythology to actual science. But the answer probably lies, you know, I think a reasonable answer to it would be maybe sometime in kind of like the early 1900s with the study of calorie restriction, both done in model organisms and also in humans. And this kind of eventually led to the work of Leonard Hayflick and Lenny Hayflick. In essence, he worked a lot on telomere biology and kind of showing that cells in a dish do not divide indefinitely. There's this, in essence, distinct replicative lifespan in a dish. And I think this was very transformative to people in terms of realizing maybe the limits of aging, or what may be, you know, a distinct part of the aging process. And then, you know, pretty much in kind of the same era of a decade or so later, we got to see the very first quote unquote longevity genes, which, yeah, you're spot on. AGE1. It originally came out in a paper from Michael Klass, I think it was 1983. And it came from an unbiased screen in worms, where they in essence gave worms a mutagen that caused a bunch of single gene mutations. And they ended up getting, I think, like 8 or 10 strains that were long lived out of that. And they didn't realize until kind of subsequent follow-up papers, but eventually they were able to characterize that I think all of those mutations were a part of AGE1, this gene that was shown to be kind of the first to increase lifespan, and increase lifespan in the worms by about 50%. And then this eventually led to a second longevity gene, DAF2, from Cynthia Kenyon's work at UCSF. She several times called it the Grim Reaper gene. And this kind of eventually led to more of this modern field of being able to study kind of single gene mutations and look at their effect on health span and lifespan.
Cool. I guess the question is, what changed, right? Because, you know, people ask me, as somebody interested in longevity, what should I do, right? You know, and I think even 5 years ago, what I would tell people is, you know, don't die from stupid things, you know, drive carefully, you know, eat well, sleep well, exercise. But other than that, there was nothing really to move the needle. Has something changed in the last 5 years that, you know, you're excited about? I'll start with Joe, I guess.
I think as a secular trend, one, we're just getting a lot better at biology in the last 5 years. And we're made of biology, and aging is caused through biological mechanisms. And that just makes it faster to figure out what's going on and how it works. And 5 years has been a really meaningful time. Like, people started doing single cell. Like, I think single cell was one of the most significant steps forward in understanding biology. Before that, people thought of, you know, there was this epic moment of sequencing the human genome that happened in, you know, 2001-ish, right? But turns out that all our cells are not exactly identical. We seem to be composed of all these different cells that are doing different stuff, like skin cells and brain cells and germ cells. And getting to the point where we could actually look at our tissue as an assembly of this rich, extremely diverse, multi-interacting assembly of all these different dozens and hundreds of cell types, I think that kicked off another inflection point in bio, as far as I observe it. And, you know, we started doing single cell sequencing earlier, but it seemed like roughly within the last 5 years, I think the bioinformatics have started to catch up. You know, because there's this interplay between kind of like people making tools and then people figuring out how to use the tools and learning much about the biology or any science in general. And then the tool makers thinking, saying, hey, there's some new stuff. I'm making new tools. And there's these cycles that go back and forth. And I think in the last 5 years, people really started figuring out how to make meaning out of the data that the single cell sequencing tool was generating. Now we're seeing a rush of new machines being built. Then they'll have to catch up and figure out what to do with the data and so on. I think that's been the biggest trend, but that's just a sort of a general biology trend. And then I think in terms of the aging field, one of the things that happens when you're watching from afar in any given overall exponential process, like I think things sort of gather steam with time. First, it's just a few kind of fringe researchers, like throwing mutagens on worms. They're interested in aging. One here or there, people saying what if in a very open-minded scientific way. And then there's another one and someone else reads their paper a year later and thinks, okay, that was a pretty disciplined, scientifically rigorous way of studying this. I guess I could do that too. This isn't all just like, live forever religion weirdos that don't do real science. And I think more people read those papers and more people get involved. And that's an exponential process. More than two people read a paper. And so I think that this field has been taking hold as a rigorous and legitimate scientific endeavor exponentially. If you're looking at it from an outside linear point of view on an exponential process, it tends to look like nothing's happening and then all of a sudden something's happening. There's this elbow in the curve. And I think that's where we are right now. We're at the point where this exponential process is starting to make a linear dent in all of bio academia. And then usually academia kind of starts something and says, hey, this is possible. Look at these phenomena. And then business can then jump in afterward and say, wow, yeah, it's possible. Let's make it actualized for people.
Yeah, for me, I have to say my excitement for this space always started, the science behind this space always started with just basic understanding of the rule of nature. Like nothing in what we are trying to do doesn't invalidate the rules of physics. Like it seems like we should be able to solve the problem. And I just gave a talk in a longevity conference and I started it by saying, first, nature solved aging, right? If you think about an 80-year-old, he can have a baby with a 40-year-old, and that baby will have the same lifespan as a baby born to two teenagers, right? There is something magical about nature, otherwise we wouldn't exist, that Joe might disagree, but when you zero everything out, when you start with an embryo, you kind of reset lifespan, right? It's kind of magical, otherwise we wouldn't exist, any species would exist. And the second thing I like to say is humans solved aging. When you think about aging of our cars or our buildings, how we solve the aging for cars, we just keep replacing parts. So the basic, I think, can be solved. Like there is nothing in what we're trying to achieve that is impossible. We just need to find scientifically valid ways of doing it. And that takes me to the state of the art, right? Alex, you're investing in the space. So to move things forward, what would you consider is the most cutting edge topics in the space right now?
Yeah, I think probably along those lines, because I mean, in part, what's so funny is like a lot of the things that we're so excited about today, scientists and folks were very excited about in the 1990s, for example. And like the whole notion of replacement parts or, being able to target biological pathways that slow or prevent the rate of aging more broadly. Like both of these were, extremely hot topics of discussion in the 90s among the very niche scientists in this community. And so then it's like, okay, well, why the heck are like now we're like still just as excited about it and yet feel so much more justified in our excitement about it versus then. And I think it really is like the progress of tools and the basic science behind these things. And kind of to segue into your question of like, a cool example is, the fact that, back in the 90s, everybody's talking about this ability to have replacement parts. And, you give this reference to the car and like, this was something actually that Len Hayflick talked about a decent amount where he was like, oh, we actually haven't solved aging in a car because you can only replace parts for so long before the car still fails to some point. I mean, what's so interesting from like the human version of that is, we wanted replacement parts back in the 90s. People talked about it and people talked about it all throughout the early 2000s in terms of having the ability to replace a cell in the human body. And we really weren't able to actually feasibly do it and show that we could do it in humans safely and effectively until the past 3 years or so. And this part is really remarkable to me. And then it's a question of like, what changed to enable us to get to this place where we actually have the ability to have like cell therapies that are, derived from off the shelf that we can, in essence, put in a human and they'll long-term survive and engraft and kind of serve a useful purpose. And in part, it was like Shinya Yamanaka's amazing Nobel Prize-winning work around cellular reprogramming. In part, it was on the backbone of a lot of scientists who had to optimize the process of kind of differentiating cell types from iPSCs. And in part, it was just a lot of people who made all the other sort of subtle subtle optimizations that needed to happen from a delivery perspective and otherwise to like get the conditions just right to show that we could do it with just a couple of cell types. And, you know, the evidence and reward of this has been, we saw just a couple weeks ago, a company in the Parkinson's disease space that was in essence able to show that they could take these cells derived off the shelf and implant them in a human Parkinson's brain and show that they could survive and have function for up to 18 months in humans. And so like, yeah, this is an area I'm just absolutely incredibly excited about. That company being Blue Rock Therapeutics with several others working in that same space and showing some really cool preliminary evidence in humans. Like, are we actually at that point that we can now replace any cell type in the body, right? And then like, what could get us from now to that goal? Or, you know, likewise with human organs, also insanely excited about that right now.
As obviously you talked about partial reprogramming, Joe, I think your company is known to be working in that space. What drew you to that specific modalities?
I would say effect sizes, like the things that people talk about in the longevity biotech space. You know, there are these molecules you could take, for instance, metformin. Yeah, it seems like it probably slows aging. If you give it to mice over long periods of time, they'll live like 10% longer if you give them metformin. But I have this kind of impatient entrepreneur blood in me that I like things that are fast moving and make big changes. And the phenotypes that I saw in the reprogramming literature were just huge. You know, you treat these animals for a relatively short period of time, and then the shifts in the sort of aging characteristics of their tissues of various kinds were quickly changed. You know, animals had improved memory outcomes, DNA had less damage, a pretty wide range of differences across tissue and quickly induced. So I think I would rather work with something as an entrepreneur that's kind of like a bit of a wild bucking bronco and kind of learn to tame it and to coax it into a particular direction than to take the sort of slow worn out mule and try to like gird it into action. It's just more exciting for me as an entrepreneur.
So as a founder, what do you think your product will be in the end? Will it be a small molecule or an antibody or whatever modality that will slow down aging? Or will it be something old people take to rejuvenate and to be younger? What do you think your product will be in the end?
I'm definitely biased toward rejuvenation over slowing aging. Yeah, you know, at some point, probably I have to acknowledge a bit of personal bias there too. Because, you know, if I were in my 20s, I would probably want to be developing things that I could take over the whole course of my life and slow me down. But I'm older than that. But it's not about me. I just like to be able to acknowledge my biases if they do exist. So we're not a single product company. We're a single mission company. I have 5 parallel research teams working on different aspects of aging, different modalities. I mean, they have different intervention methods. So we have a small molecule program in our autophagy group. We have 3 different cell therapy programs, and then another one that's basically a gene therapy program. So a bunch of different products, and I'm pretty intensely product oriented. Like, we are not academia. We make products for people to take and make their lives better, but I'm not focused on any particular modality. Like, I'm therapeutic intervention agnostic.
But how do you get it approved? Suddenly, aging is not a disease. That's what the FDA said. You need to get approval for a disease. So how do you get approval for rejuvenation?
Yeah, funny. I was visiting Japan recently and met the prime minister. It was interesting. In Japan, you can put that someone died of old age on a birth certificate. And I'm kind of interested in the conversation there, that if that's true, then theoretically you should be able to make a therapeutic that prevents that cause of death, right? So I want to continue that conversation in Japan. However, right now I'm in the US and that is not a thing. Aging is not a disease or a cause of death. So what we have to do is use what I call proxy indications, which means that diseases that are caused by the same mechanism that we're working on, but that typically are more acute, where there's a more kind of immediate need, preferably an unmedical need, and the ones that, you know, there's an existing ICD code for, and that, you know, you can actually get an approval from FDA to market a drug for that. So that's basically every single program has to have one of those. And then the idea is that we deliver a medicine for a proxy indication first, and then that establishes the mechanism is functional in people. It gets the therapy out there, can establish a safety track record for it, and then sort of open minds and doors to being able to expand into larger indications. And then I think this should be the ultimate path, as you alluded to earlier, Omri, for all medicine. Ultimately, should be able to be used preventatively.
Yeah, the best healthcare is to stay healthy, as I like to say. Interesting what you said about Japan and dying from old age. I think in the US, they call it natural reasons, right? You know, natural causes. And I think there is nothing natural of dying of old age. You know, natural is dying when you're 22 from infection, you know, and we don't call it natural today. And I think in 100 years, looking back, dying at the age of 70 from old age will be looked very primitive, a very sad thing. Well, let's talk about investment and how investors see the longevity space. You know, my day job is general partner and effects. We're a big seed fund. You know, we take money from LPs, we invest in companies, we need to show returns. And the reason we like longevity is A, we think it's the biggest market. It's for everyone. B, it's very magical. Like if you really invent something that rejuvenates you and make you younger, like who wouldn't want that? And it will be totally magical, defensible thing to do. And it drives the most passionate people to the space. So you get the best founders like Joe. So maybe Alex, you know, you're an investor like us. So what's the framework that you use to evaluate companies in the space?
Yeah. Well, obviously looking for Joes. I don't know. Maybe we just need to clone more of him. That's the easy solution. But
I can do it. I can do it. I have a company for that.
In essence, like, you know, I think there's kind of like the three things that I'm constantly thinking about with potential founders, which is just like, one, do they have extraordinarily high judgment and like ability to make right decisions? Two, are, you know, is at least somebody on a founding team mission aligned to the aging field and the long-term goals of the field? And three, are they willing to be a founder? Kind of like think on those three axes as of like evaluating potential founders or potential talent that, you know, are the kind of next generation Joes that kind of help push the field forward. And that's kind of like the immediate access that I'm evaluating. I think at least at age one, we take a super kind of founder focused viewpoint, and that kind of under that first bucket of like a founder's judgment, so many other of the standard kind of VC evaluations come into the picture, right? Because like, how do you evaluate somebody's judgment? Well, I want to know like how they view path to market, how they view particular science in a specific area, who they can attract to, you know, associate with from a like scientific advisor perspective, kind of like what is their ability to like run through walls to make that happen. And so I think like all of those kind of fold into this bucket of like, is this aging company investable on, you know, venture scale, like 7 to 10 year timeline, right? But kind of fits in that higher order framework, which I think it really comes down to like just a founder's judgment.
Cool. So you talked a lot about founders. Obviously, founders are very important, but let's talk about a little bit about the risks of longevity companies. One of them is something that Joe just mentioned, right? The FDA still don't recognize aging as a disease. You need to find an adjacent indication. I call it fake longevity indications because, you know, some people go after osteoporosis of the knee and they don't develop a drug for osteoporosis. They develop a drug for aging that might also help with osteoporosis, but might not be, you know, the best efficacy for that, right? So it's harder to get approval. What other risks do you see for companies in this space?
I think losing your way is a risk. I think it happens to people in any kind of mission-focused situation. This isn't really the full mission, but it's practical for us to work on in the short term. And then they focus on that forever and they never kind of make it back. I guess that's more of like getting back to like personal founder risk, but it's something that I constantly repeat back. Like if we're in strategy sessions, which we do twice a year, and I'll constantly be bringing back up, yes, we could go that direction, but I think it would take us off track and we need to keep moving our focus back. Even if it means we face more risk of certain kinds or less immediate reward, it's worth it. And we're in a privileged position of having patient capital, like just our investor, I guess the equivalent of your LPs, have a reasonably long-term view. I mean, also personally, from a founder perspective, impatient and obsessed with pace, as am I. It's a really hard problem. And I think one needs to think on longer timescales to get there. Like, I don't necessarily think that we're going to hit our entire mission within a 7-year venture timeframe. I believe we'll make a dent for sure. We'll for sure ship our first drug and then our next one and then our next one and then our next one. And eventually we'll hit our mission. I guess there's business risks. Like, one thing I see happening over and over again in the biotech industry, and it makes me sad, is that you see a lot of companies start off with toward a mission and with a particular discovery platform and really believing in the science and the power of the science and in the depth of their pipeline. We have this platform. It's a novel way of discovering therapeutics against particular, you know, set of diseases or whatever. And then it's going to be able to generate like dozens of cures for all these things. They get one thing that's kind of started heading toward the clinic. They de-risk certain aspects of it and they start running out of money. And then they go talk to investors and the investors are like, I don't know about all this like kind of like nerdy stuff. Like the science-y discovery stuff with all those PhDs is like, I can't quite figure, I don't really understand it that well. But this drug that looks like it's about to go into phase 1, That makes sense. I see the business sense of that. So I'll invest into that, but you have to lay off your discovery team. So you see these companies constantly start off more optimistic and idealistic. And like, I guess I have a bias toward deep tech, I guess you would call it. I mean, that's the buzzword in the investment community. But I believe that the important changes that have happened throughout human history that really give us our incredible lifestyle today have been from not so much from, just like figuring out that we should have curbs be 6 inches high on the street instead of 8 inches high or whatever, but have been more like putting in the research and figuring out how to make a really good rocket engine or how to hybridize clone DNA, et cetera. And so it's sad to me to see these organizations getting deep teched over and over again. That's a kind of a business risk in a way. So it's inspiring to me when I see a company starting to do well in the investors. And I guess they've done a good job at communicating with their investors and helping share the vision, not only of this first item, but their whole pipeline and the thesis behind it. And they can keep R&D funded.
Yeah, the only thing that matters, if you look back in history, the only thing that matters is science and technology. Everything else is just games. That's the only thing that moves productivity and the human condition forward. I think we all agree on that. And let's talk a little bit about the fundraising side, because all of us had to fundraise for longevity. So Alex, you had to fundraise from LPs to raise your fund. And Joe, you had to fundraise from other funds or angels to raise money for longevity. So Alex, let's start with you. You'd think that every person with money, if you scratch him, he's a longevity buff. He wants to be healthy and live longer. Was it easy or was it hard? How was your experience raising money for this fund?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if there's ever easy fundraising unless you're maybe like a machine learning company or something at Silicon Valley these days. I think almost any fundraising is hard, even in like the easiest of circumstances. So I'd say it was like way easier than I expected, but I also expected to be swallowing glass for a year. And I would say it was like a slightly more pleasant experience than that, but it was definitely a year grind of just making it happen, even though it was a pleasant experience. So in essence, what was the experience like? I mean, I think I found out, for example, that like through some global travels, people now, just when you mention longevity anywhere kind of outside the US, they just think of Brian Johnson and they ask you if that's what you mean by the longevity field. So I've learned kind of how global the field has gone in terms of it getting name recognition. In terms of exactly kind of how that process goes and kind of people's comfort with the field, I mean, I think people do start to see it as one of these opportunities that they need to track. And even a lot of the more standard, bigger, traditional funds, it's on their radar now. Maybe not as something that they're actively investigating, but it's at least on their radar, which I think is a crazy difference. I think back just 10 years ago, 11 years ago, to Laura launching the first fund out of the longevity fund vehicle, and like how hard that must have been to approach people for an industry that didn't even exist yet. And now we get to sit here with the luxury of saying, there's, what, like over 180 different companies in this space, and people have heard about it for better or worse, sometimes in either direction. So I think that's a really cool change that's happened in the fundraising landscape, is just it's more on people's radars than it's ever been before.
Yeah, I think we all agree that longevity might not be the best names. I think there is a big Venn diagram of people thinking about longevity, what it means. Some people think it's cream. Some people think it's extreme biohacking like Brian Johnson. I think we're in the camp of like the deep science, rational thing that can move the needle and, prevent diseases. I think that's the camp that we're, if I can generalize, that we are all in. But I want to talk bigger about the business case for longevity, right? Because, not only it's the biggest market in the world, I'm about to write a blog post about the business of longevity. I want to call it longevity, the L in LTV. So LTV means lifetime value, right? So in my hypothesis that not only everybody would like to have the longevity drug, but it makes all other markets better because it increases the lifetime of your customers. They just live longer to consume whatever product or service you're creating. Somebody made a business case for, the economic value of adding one healthy year for adults in the US. It was something in the trillions of dollars. So again, it's so surprising why there are no more investment in longevity than there are. So, Alex, like, why do you think longevity companies are great businesses to invest in?
Yeah, like in part, like some of the biggest returns and, examples or areas of the best financial returns ever seen are kind of in areas where historically the opportunity has just been completely overlooked and you have massive, massive markets at play. And I think that sums up the longevity space to a T. We wrote a blog post about it probably like 3 or 4 months ago, just in terms of the like possible market that's achievable with the first FDA-approved longevity drug. And, you know, we concluded it would be about $150 to $200 billion per year in annual revenue. So this would be, in essence, 3 to 4 times the size of the entire market of GLP-1 receptor agonists, your Ozempic, Wegovy, that Mounjaro, that has been, you know, totally transforming economies of European countries. Like, if you look at the growth of Novo Nordisk, just becoming like the most valuable company in Europe, I'm pretty sure, right? It's like, and that's, you know, a third or a fourth of the size and magnitude of the effect that the longevity field is going to see and experience. And we just know that that's going to be the case. The market pull is there. It will happen. It's just a matter of when. So I think you're spot on. I'm super excited to read your post because it's the massive market that's involved and the very few shots that have been actually taken to achieve that market. It's a huge mismatch in terms of shots on net and the rewards for scoring.
I think one of the challenges the space has is that proud to be in a space that has this category, this characteristic, that there is a lot of sort of external value created. And what I mean by internal and external is there's a system in which the investment is made and the product is produced and revenue directly generated from the product. And then there are the other effects on the rest of the world. You can make a like high-speed race car or whatever, and you can get paid X number of dollars every time someone buys one. I don't know about the externalities for that. You know, maybe it's just like incredibly inefficient and causes lots of pollution and noise and like people die often from them and like whatever. It's like, maybe they make the world a little bit worse place. But, you know, you can categorize products that way. I think there have been really good, well-reasoned and detailed, carefully calculated cases made for longevity therapeutics that produce them, and pretty much everything gets better society-wise. The amount of time that you have to support people, there's like the younger population has to support the older population, that there's this sort of like ratio that has to do, you know, it's like terrible in Japan and Korea right now, you know, the retirement versus non-retirement, how long can people work basically versus, that's a huge, huge effect. People are healthier longer and can remain productive rather than being a burden to society. You don't necessarily get paid for that by making your longevity drug, not necessarily, just like it has effects on families, on society, on productivity, on forward progress. And there are a bunch of things like that, that all ripple out from making good, healthy longevity drugs that you don't necessarily get paid for directly. But I think there are enough still that can be money that flows back into the same industry that produces them, which is a virtuous cycle where they can produce more such drugs using that money, because it takes money to fuel R&D, that there are enough that will still incentivize people to continue this exponential growth.
Yeah, I totally agree. And Alex, by the way, I think it's kind of funny that you mentioned GLP drugs like Ozempic, etc., because when I look back at the biggest pharma hit in the last 5 years, which is GLP drugs and even the COVID vaccines, in my mind, those two things are longevity drugs. It's things that you give to healthy people so they won't become diseased, right? You know, overweight, take that drug so you won't get NASH, so you won't get diabetes, right? So you won't get heart attack. So we see the value of those drugs, and those are the biggest drugs categories ever. It's something you give to everybody to keep them healthy. So yeah, I think the business case has already been made by other drugs, but now let's attack the root cause. Let's talk about the future and kind of advice for founders. Let's start with, what do you think the long-term society effect will be if this space will be developed as we think it will? How the world would look different if we have those drugs?
I mean, the easiest way to think about that for me is, well, how does the world look different today from how it looked 100 years ago when people lived shorter lifespans? You know, life was nastier, shorter, and more brutish. I think people will look back on now from the future and just be like, oh, man, that sucked. I'm sorry that people had to live back then. I get it. You know, I read the 21st century literature and it's pretty brutal life. You don't know, you know, people are like dying of Alzheimer's and all these other like fundamentally treatable things because I guess they just didn't have the medicine then. So it'll be a little bit sort of gritty reality and a bit of pity probably.
Yeah, definitely. So we talk about vaccine, you know. So again, you take something and you never get viral infection if we get better vaccine, you know. You take GLP-1 inhibitors and you're always fit and sexy, right? You know, you take partially programming creams and your skin looks young and you grow the hair back. That's something that I feel personally about. Yeah, like some people hate their birthdays. I always celebrate my birthday as a milestone. I survived another year in my goal of living in the future, because the future is going to be awesome if the company we invested in, the company you are working on, Joe, will work out, right? Because we'll have the solution for all of that. And I think some people are worried about, oh, it's going to go to rich people. And to that, I say an expensive solution is better than no solution. An expensive solution tend to get cheaper over time. You know, patent runs out and everything becomes cheaper and more accessible to everybody else. I'm excited about the future. I want to live in that future. Even if it's cost a lot, one of the science fiction books I read, the way they fund the longevity treatment is people saved, instead of saving for retirement, they saved for the longevity treatment that took them back to 18 years old, and they call it second life and third life. And one saying in the book is, life sucks, then you rejuvenate and do it all over again, which is way better than our option right now. So again, for both of you, I guess the same question, just to close this really inspiring discussion. You know, if you think about, you know, a bunch of founders will be listening to this podcast, what's the one thing you want to tell them about the space and why they should be part of it and, you know, the future of longevity?
I mean, I guess, again, my hammer is making companies. So that's pretty much the only thing I consider myself qualified to speak on. But, and you also asked earlier about, like, so what is the process of fundraising like? Me, it's been the absolute peak experience of my career to focus on something that is an incredibly exciting and inspiring mission. It makes hiring easier. It makes fundraising easier. It makes motivation for myself, for everyone, just automatic. So I think that for people wondering, what should I do with my life? What should I do with my career? Whatever that is. I've always been confused by the concept of what a career is, because it's always just me and, like, what should I do today? If you realize that you personally really feel this worldview in a deep and vivid way, like, yeah, it makes sense that the world would be a better place if people are not dying of such horrible age-related diseases at the ages that they're dying of, then it makes it easier for you to live an authentic and successful life. Just seek out companies that think and believe like you do and work with the people. You'll get up every day being excited to be working on the problem that you're working on. You'll be working with people who get you and who are also excited about it. It makes teamwork easier. It's less sort of every person for themselves, just sort of how I see much of academia, and more of, like, what are we going to accomplish as a team, which is an incredible feeling. I'm the happiest I've ever been running this company. And if I'm making decisions, they're not based on, well, this is what I want you to do for me. It's like, I think this is the right thing for us to do as a company in order to achieve our mission. So I'm out of the way, like, my ego is out of the way. So I guess as an advice to someone, get involved in something that you deeply believe in, and, like, many other obstacles will just, like, melt away in your life.
Very cool. Alex?
I love that. So, I mean, for those people who that speaks to, I'll go a little bit more tactical. I think there's, like, three massive, you know, I mean, there's way more than this, but three core challenges I'd identify that, like, are actually semi-feasible on a, like, 30 to 50 year timescale and would be the most transformative to society that we've ever seen in terms of a company transform society, which I think is, like, one is, like, figuring out how to manipulate aging for each tissue in the body. I think there's probably, like, pretty tissue specific targets to aging, and figuring out ways to do that, whether that's with reprogramming modalities or transcription factor based screening, or, you know, who knows, like, whatever the intervention is, just figuring out how to do that would be unbelievably remarkable. Second one would be to figure out a way to be able to replace any single damaged cell in the body or aged cell in the body with a young, fresh one and get it to be where it needs to be and have it be happy and performing its functions. And the third would be to be able to do the same with every tissue in the body. And I think these are, like, grand challenges. They sound insane, but on a 30 to 50 year timescale, who knows? Like, maybe feasible with the pace that we're seeing things accelerate and machine learning. Like, who knows? So I would say, take Joe's advice, go after one of those three buckets, and you may build the most transformative company that's ever graced the earth.
Amazing, amazing. So again, you heard it first. You know, aging is a disease. It's a root cause of most diseases. We can tackle it. People are tackling it. People are investing in it. So please, you know, if you're excited about what you heard right now, get up and join a company, start a company, and do something in the space. You know, we can do it. Thank you very much, all of you. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Oli. Pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks a ton.